KRWT News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. New Mexico has administered hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 vaccines. But reaching seniors with limited mobility, transportation, and technology remains a concern for government officials. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Las Cruces Assistant City Manager Eric Enriquez outlined some of the challenges of reaching the senior population for COVID vaccination.
The top challenge is the technology. There's a lot of seniors out there that don't have access to computers or registering for the vaccination. So the city is creating a vaccine task force. And this task force will be comprised of a lot of leaders in the community to get resources out there, such as funding, education, communication, using as much of the leadership in the community to help those that are vulnerable and have challenges with getting the vaccination. So the seniors, the elderly, that's one of the priorities.
For Lynette Tompton, a senior in Las Cruces, the matter is personal. In Group 1B, she is patiently waiting for the opportunity to schedule a vaccination appointment. She stresses that getting vaccinated is a matter of life or death for the people in her age group.
If they don't get vaccinated, they're probably going to die because they're older, and most seniors, even if they've been healthy their whole life, by the time you're in your 60s, normally you start to have some underlying conditions that you didn't have when you were younger. We can't just put these old people out on a piece of ice like they used to in the olden days. And I realize that there's a lot of younger people that don't value seniors, and they don't care if we die. But we care if we die. You know, we do care.
But Tompton is without a car, leaving her unable to access drive-through vaccination sites on her own, like the one on the New Mexico State University campus. To get around Las Cruces, she often uses the city's dial-a-ride service, something that has to be scheduled weeks in advance.
But the problem with them is that you have to schedule 3 weeks in advance. So if I get my appointment time, I've got 3 days to get there, I can't take the dial-a-ride.
And that's just the beginning of the challenges facing seniors who are seeking to get vaccinated at walk-in sites.
I can't stand up very long to wait in the line. Most seniors really can't. I mean, they can stay up maybe 5-10 minutes, but I'm hearing horror stories about seniors who are falling down and hurting themselves in these lines.
The city is working to address the concerns, offering wheelchairs for those that visit the Las Cruces Convention Center vaccination site. Seniors can request a wheelchair from any volunteer, such as those working in the parking lot, when they arrive at the convention center. For seniors with no ability to get to a vaccination site or limited access to the internet, Enriquez says the city's COVID-19 vaccination task force is working to reach seniors through its Meals on Wheels program.
We can make sure that we're getting these individuals vaccinated and reaching out to them either by phone or however they're listed on the Meals on Wheels, even to stop by, because they're actually making physical contact with them by dropping food off at their physical address and then scheduling them for some homebounds.
The city is also working to create a hotline for residents in need of additional help related to the pandemic. For now, anyone with concerns can call the New Mexico Department of Health's COVID-19 hotline at 1-855-600-3453. Expanding the number of vaccination sites is also being explored, with a focus on educational institutions and senior centers. Enriquez says the city's COVID-19 vaccination task force will be instrumental in getting the pandemic under control.
Really looking forward to this task force. The mayor and city council advocated for this, made a resolution, put it out there, and I think it's going to be very instrumental for getting people in the community vaccinated. We're going to do our best. We're going to charge this hard and make it happen. This is a break we've been waiting for this pandemic, and we want to get back together and living normal lives again. And so this is one task force that I think is going to be very instrumental in getting that accomplished.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, officials at some of New Mexico's largest hospitals are holding out hope that vaccine supplies will catch up with demand. They said during a briefing that they understand the wait is stressful for people who have registered to receive shots, Some have been waiting for weeks, and state health officials have acknowledged that residents have been crossing state lines in search of vaccines in Texas. KRWG News talked with Dr. William Thompson of the UNM Health Sciences Center about how officials can ensure equity in vaccine distribution.
That's going to be a two-pronged approach. Number one, we need data. So we really need every state to list who is getting the vaccinations, what race they are, what county they're coming from, what city and location they're coming from. Even if we just use zip codes, that would be one method of being able to identify if the vaccine is being distributed equally. As you're aware, the first group of people were the first responders. Every state decided that they were going to try to get as many of the first responders done. And to be honest, if you look at that group of people and demographics, you're going to have a larger percentage of non-white. Now, as we roll out the vaccine and we actually start increasing the distribution, I think we're going to start seeing a little bit more equitable distribution of the vaccine. Right now, it's just the logistics. Just getting vaccine, just getting it into people's arms. I think that's the biggest push that's right now.
And you can watch our entire conversation with Dr. William Thompson tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG TV's Newsmakers. The coronavirus has upended many aspects of American society, and child well-being is no exception. More from the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown.
A report on New Mexico's children and families shows a steady improvement in child poverty since 2016, declining from nearly 31% to 25%. But the coronavirus pandemic has slowed improvements in child well-being. Released at the start of the legislative session each year, the Kids Count Data Book provides policymakers with information on the status of children and families. In joining New Mexico Voices for Children for the report's release, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham expressed confidence families can thrive despite the health crisis.
I want to make sure that we do everything we can to create individual and family security, particularly given the number of single heads of household and the current unemployment rates still in New Mexico.
In 2020, state lawmakers passed an income tax cut for 70% of families with children and improved higher education, affordability, and access. Lujan Grisham said this year the state is on track to greatly expand education and care programs for the youngest children, possibly from the land-grant permanent fund. The data book tracks indicators including economic security, education, health, and family and community. Voices for Children Executive Director James Jimenez says 11 of the 16 well-being indicators were moving in the right direction between 2019 and 2020.
Children with health insurance, that continues to move in the right direction. We're down to just 6% of children do not have access to health insurance. So 94% of our kids do. That's a great statistic.
75% of kids in New Mexico are children of color. Kids Count Coordinator Emily Wildow says that means policies must focus on racial equity if the state is going to improve health and well-being for the majority of the state's children.
And as we move forward, we need to consider the ways in which the bias of seemingly colorblind policies are holding many children of color in our state back from reaching their full potential.
The report also noted that more young children, ages 3 and 4, were enrolled in school. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Business news now, and the Biden administration is considering an increase in royalty rates on oil, gas, and coal development on public lands for the first time in more than a century. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
President Biden ordered the Interior Department to consider adjusting just how much of a cut taxpayers get when companies drill on public lands. These are called royalties, and they have stayed at 12.5% for a really long time. Biden wants to make them higher to offset climate costs. Robert Godby is an energy expert at the University of Wyoming. He says the oil and gas industry is already hurting due to the pandemic. This will make business more difficult.
But in the longer term, this is an industry under stress anyway. And there may be a limited time that that resource has value. So let's maximize that value while we can still get it.
Godby says there are already a handful of states that charge more in royalty rates for oil, gas, and coal extracted from state-managed public lands. He stresses that this review of federal royalty rates is in its infancy, and it could be a long time before we see any results. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau brought to you in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Texas business leaders have launched a new coalition in support of protecting the state's 100,000 dreamers from deportation. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has more on how business leaders, including some state Republicans, are rallying behind these undocumented immigrants.
The newly founded Texas Opportunity Coalition will lobby in favor of finding a permanent solution for dreamers to stay in the country legally, citing their contributions to the economy and healthcare industry. Dreamers are undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. The coalition will lobby on behalf of dreamers with the public support of Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn. President Biden has proposed legislation to protect dreamers and create a pathway to citizenship for the country's 11 million undocumented immigrants. In a virtual press conference on the new coalition, Republican political strategist Karl Rove shared this about Biden's proposal.
This was a key element of President George W. Bush's 2005, 6, and 7 efforts. The principles behind it in 2020 and 2007, I think, are applicable today. First of all, you have to give people a limited time in order to surface, and you have to give them a background check.
This comes as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, faces a Texas-led legal challenge, which puts the future of hundreds of thousands of dreamers in jeopardy. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Well, there is a push in Congress for comprehensive immigration reform, which has been endorsed by President Joe Biden. But representatives are also speaking out about the need to address some of the consequences of immigration policies during the Trump administration. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar says that the U.S. must reunite every family separated at the southern border under Trump-era immigration policies. The El Paso Democrat spoke with MSNBC.
We need to make sure that we provide the resources necessary to find every single one of those families that was separated. We also have an obligation to provide for mental health care for those families.
Escobar has launched a Congressional Moms Task Force focused on reuniting migrant families. The witness to the El Paso Walmart mass shooting, who was recently deported, has now shared her story. She also applied for a special visa that protects crime victims who cooperate with law enforcement. KTEP's Angela Cocherga has more from El Paso.
During a phone call from Juarez, Rosa says she's struggling to adapt after spending much of her life in El Paso.
I've been there since I was 13. I'm 27 already.
Her attorney asks that we only use her first name because she's a witness in the Walmart mass shooting case. Rosa says she made it clear to an ICE agent that she had applied for what's called a U visa, which protects undocumented victims of crime who cooperate with law enforcement. She says the ICE agent said, quote, "There's nothing in the computer.
If they need you, they're going to give you a permit so you can come back and testify. If they don't need you, they're not going to need you back."
But according to ICE, neither Rosa nor her attorney made it known that she's a cooperating witness in the Walmart case.
When he put me in the bridge, I didn't know where I was going or anything. So I was just in tears, like literally in tears. I couldn't talk.
Rosa's lawyer says the pandemic slowed the process of submitting her visa application, which today is part of a backlog. Rosa says despite the risks of deportation, she would come forward again to offer testimony.
It's better to help. It's better to tell why you think is right.
Rosa's attorney is petitioning for her return while her visa application is processed. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. In 2020, the city of Las Cruces adopted a climate action plan, pledging a 19% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And now the city council is taking steps to guarantee that goal is met. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The Las Cruces City Council listened to a presentation by SWEEP, the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project. The presentation was prompted by a resolution proposed by Councilor Gil Sorg, calling on the City of Las Cruces to ensure climate goals are met through proactive planning. While the resolution itself is yet to be voted on, Sorg spoke about the importance of implementing concrete changes, specifically stressing the need for the city to invest in more electric vehicles.
I would just like to have this resolution be a part of their decision making when they decide on a vehicle. The fact that we have an older fleet, this is a great opportunity to replace those vehicles with something that's more environmentally sound.
Taking steps to address climate change is of growing importance, according to state climatologist David Dubois, who recently told KRWG that temperatures in New Mexico have continued to rise.
The last 30 years, we've seen a climb in temperature. It's a small climb. It's that continuous. Every year, we see a shift in warmer temperatures. You know, there are natural cycles that are going on, like El Niños and La Niñas, that we see up and down trends. But there's this long-term warming that's underlying all of that.
Focusing on transportation will be a key factor in cutting emissions for the city, as the sector is the biggest polluter, making up 53% of total greenhouse gas emissions in Las Cruces. SWEEP Senior Transportation Associate Matt Frommer outlined some of the steps the city can take to promote electric vehicle use.
The question for Las Cruces is, what can local governments do to accelerate EV adoption? The first one is city fleet electrification. So leading by example, walking the walk. Number two is increasing access to EV charging stations by building public charging stations, working with utilities, and then adopting EV-ready building codes.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima advocated for a change to new construction building codes, requiring homes to have enough electric capacity for the charging of electric vehicles.
We probably need to give our home builders at least a year advance notice, is that perhaps in about a year we're going to start requiring that new home constructions have at least wired for that type of electricity. If they were to have an electric car, they don't have to have the home rewired, or they don't have to have the home remodified. And that's also good because of, as new subdivisions come in, Paso Electric has to need to know what the new load will be, because they have to be able to provide that.
Councillor Gabe Vasquez asked if electric vehicles would still be reliant on fossil fuel when charging.
There's this dynamic about continuing to rely on electricity that is still being produced by fossil fuels. And so even though we don't have the individual, perhaps, emitters, right, those fossil fuels are still being extracted.
SWEEP Industrial Program Designer Neil Colwey says New Mexico's Energy Transition Act will require utilities to generate an increased amount of power from renewable energy sources.
It does require all the New Mexico utilities to have a plan to go to 50% renewables by 2030. So that's a pretty aggressive goal, and they have to hit that. So they will be working on phasing out their coal plants.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo emphasized the importance of discussing how to combat climate change, saying the conversation will continue among city councillors.
I think governments and industry particularly have a very key role to play actually in the way that we're going to see climate change sort of come to be in the next few decades. And I think one of the biggest things we can do as a municipal government is really advocate for policies that hold extractive industries accountable.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
From local to state politics now, and we continue our conversations with New Mexico lawmakers from our listening area during this legislative session. This week, we hear from District 34 Republican State Senator Ron Griggs, who is sponsoring a bill that, if approved, could lead to some major changes to New Mexico liquor licenses. He spoke with Anthony Moreno.
SB 6, the Liquor Control Act you're sponsoring, this bill would amend and enact parts of the Liquor Control Act to allow delivery of alcohol beverages to homes. Now it also creates a new type of license allowing sale of certain alcoholic beverages in restaurants, and there's additional fees, and there's also changes to the rules for dispensers who have a license. Can you tell us a little bit about this bill and how you think it can help small businesses and consumers here in New Mexico?
Anthony, we don't have enough time to talk about this bill in depth, but real quickly, what it does for restaurants who have who've been, you know, reduced to carry out and all the things that have been going on with restaurants. It allows these guys to be able to sell beer and wine with a meal. So if you need to come by and pick up your your enchiladas from La Posta, you could also pick up a six pack of beer, because I believe the number is 72 ounces. So you could pick that up. And will that help help La Posta? Probably a small bit, but it will help La Posta some. That's what that part of it does. It allows as well. There's different categories of licenses in New Mexico, and to fully understand that is a lengthy discussion. But there are licenses right now that are able to sell food, but they can't sell alcohol off premise. So what this allows is those licenses as well to be able to sell or send alcohol off premise. The beer and wine licenses are able to sell alcohol off premise. So that helps. There's a type of license in New Mexico. It's called an interlocal license. That license is not allowed to sell packaged liquor. They can sell liquor by the drink in their restaurant, but they can't sell packaged liquor. This bill changes that and allows them the opportunity to buy back the part of that existing license that allowed them to sell packaged, to buy that back. That way, then they have that license and they can sell that license across the state. So it's an opportunity for those guys. There are other guys in New Mexico that have licenses that solely allow them to sell packaged. That particular license has gone for as much as $1 million or so in New Mexico. This bill probably impacts the value of that license, because more licenses then become available that can be sold across the state. So will they actually sell more licenses across the state? Will they move? You know, that's anybody's guess. But because they could, the values become different. And anybody can tell you, well, they're going to drop to nothing or they're going to drop to half. I don't think anybody knows. That's really dependent on the market and how many people choose to sell their license across local option district lines that currently can't.
There's obviously going to be some folks who are concerned who own these licenses. What do you have to say to them if they are planning on selling that license to retire on?
You know, that is a challenge. I certainly agree with that. There's 1,411 licenses subject to the quota system in New Mexico. 1,411. That's all there are. Then there's the beer and wine license, which is for restaurants. What this has done is it's created an economy in licenses that is unlike any other license in New Mexico. You can buy and sell and trade your license and not have to worry about buying and selling and trading your business. It has hurt economic opportunity because people come in and they cannot afford the license. There's roughly 700 and some beer and wine licenses. Many of those people would choose to sell spirits if they could, because they can't afford the license, they have not done that.
District 34 Republican State Senator Ron Griggs, it's always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Anthony. I enjoyed it.
A bill in the New Mexico legislature could pave the way toward universal health insurance coverage in the state. Some thoughts from commentator Peter Goodman.
New Mexicans can and should have a health plan that covers everyone and costs us less collectively. Repeated studies have shown it's feasible. House Bill 203 would provide for a careful, detailed design of the plan, which would take effect only if the governor and legislature approved the final design. A huge coalition supports the bill, as do resolutions passed by Las Cruces, Anthony, and Doñana County. The plan would ensure almost all residents, federal retirees, and military folks would continue with their federal plans, as could ERISA-covered health plans. Plan members would have guaranteed access to comprehensive, quality health care coverage, regardless of income, health, or employment. The plan guarantees choice of provider, even across state lines, and is at least as good a benefit package as state employees receive. Hospitals and physicians would remain private. The plan would be run by an independent, non-governmental, 15-member Health Security Plan Commission, with 10 commissioners from around the state representing consumers and employers, and 5 representing providers and health facilities. The Open Meetings Act and Inspection of Public Records Act would apply, but patient confidentiality would be protected. Rather than all paying for a segmented system of hundreds of insurance plans at greater cost and with greater complexity, everyone would be in one large pool, sharing the risk and reducing administrative costs. Public and private dollars would go into one fund, including federal and state health care money, Affordable Care Act federal subsidies, plus individual premiums and employer contributions with caps. Employers could cover all or part of an employee's premium. The plan, like Medicare, makes private insurance supplemental. As with Canada's excellent plan, private companies participate and make profits, but don't run the system. Nor should they. They sure don't in most well-run countries. The Affordable Care Act provides for state innovation waivers that let states develop alternative health coverage systems that need not rely on the complex private insurance system. A friend says it's too big for New Mexico. But we don't move forward unless the detailed design satisfies both the legislature and the governor. That's a limited investment for a possibly huge payoff. Meanwhile, millionaire CEOs of insurance companies get rich off our timidity. By the way, decades ago, Saskatchewan, Canada's poorest province, enacted a health care plan that worked so well it ultimately became Canada's national plan. We have a similar chance to light the way. Please read up on HB 203. If you like it, tell your legislators. Our county contains many poor and uninsured families, some with children. We owe it to them to at least make our best effort at this.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Also on the Health Watch this week, near Dallas, a pair of Collin College professors whose contracts are not being renewed say that they were ousted by leaders who did not like their views on the system's COVID-19 policies. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, the news follows months of concerns from faculty over COVID-19.
Two longtime Collin College professors say, make no mistake, they were fired, even if, on paper, they were told their contracts will not be renewed in May.
The college has been really careful over the last few days to deny that I or my colleague were fired.
Audra Heslip has taught humanities at Collin College for more than a decade.
As if it's a completely normal thing for someone who's been teaching full-time for more than 10 years with not a single student complaint, not a single disciplinary notice.
It's not normal, says Heslip, who says she was targeted for challenging the school's COVID policies. She and other faculty demanded the school publish data about the number of COVID-19 infections among employees and students. President Neil Matkin, who in August said COVID's effects were blown utterly out of proportion, wanted instructors and students back on campus as soon as possible. Heslip said that for everyone's protection, she wanted classes that could be taught online to be taught virtually. She circulated a petition that got 130 signatures. She also spoke out, including to the media.
what people are calling outspoken is speaking the truth, having integrity, and trying to make sure that we hold each other accountable. And I don't expect to agree with colleagues on everything, but I feel like we should be able to disagree without fear. There's a real toxic culture of fear.
Collin College issued a statement saying, in consideration of employee privacy, the college does not publicly comment on personnel matters. Heslip says college officials told her that her contract was not being renewed because, in part, she violated the college's core values. Education professor Suzanne Jones, who also signed Heslip's resolution, was told the same thing. Her contract also is not being renewed. Jones, who's been at the college for 20 years, feels betrayed by administrators.
I have great teacher evaluations, great student evaluations. I have my students doing service in the community all the time. I mean, like, I live by our core values. I teach the core values to my classes. You know, for them to use that on me is just questionable at best.
Jones has another theory. She's a state officer of the Texas Faculty Association, the TFA. It's like a union. She and Heslip are also officers of the Collin College chapter.
Out of our three local Collin officers, two of us were fired. So it clearly seems to be about TFA. We have our first meetup to recruit new members, so that also seems like they're sending a message.
If that's what they're doing, Adam Steinbaugh says the school has crossed the line. He's an attorney with FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education.
Under the First Amendment, the employer doesn't have to recognize a union, but you do have a First Amendment right to associate with one another in order to argue for an improvement in society or your political views or what have you. That is protected by the First Amendment.
The college generated headlines last fall when the school's president blasted a professor who went on social media criticizing former Vice President Mike Pence. Several professors have told KERA that they're afraid of losing their jobs if they speak critically of the school's leadership. Pat Heinzelman is president of the TFA, and she says she's had more calls about Collin than any other college in Texas.
Collin doesn't believe in academic freedom or shared government, and they certainly don't want any advocacy groups on their campus. They want to remove any power from faculty.
Both Heslip and Jones say they plan to file a grievance and appeal their dismissal. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Last March, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces. Every week, we are presenting portions of the interviews conducted during that visit, and today we hear from Air Force veteran Ellen Steele, who's interviewed by her friend, KRWG's Emily Guerra.
I was born in the hills of southern West Virginia. Left there when I was about 16, and then I went to Maryland, and then to Delaware, and then back home and joined the Air Force.
Do you want to talk about some of your childhood memories?
I would rather not. It was a very bumpy childhood.
Okay. What are some of the most important people in your life?
Other than my little dog? let's see. Important people. I have been married more than once. My husband was in the Army, and he served during World War II, was at the Battle of the Bulge, and also then went to Korea. We were married for 27 years.
You had a previous marriage?
Several. In fact, tomorrow, which will be March the 7th, my first child will be 62. And unfortunately, right before Thanksgiving, my daughter died of cancer.
So do you want to describe something that you were really proud of in your life?
Well, I'm proud that I survived this long. I mean, particularly me. My theory is that you need to give back to your community everything that the community gives to you. And so therefore, from the time the children were little, and I was a single parent at that time, I started getting involved in different, like the Cancer Society and the Heart Society and things of this sort, in order to give back. And then later on, I got involved in politics. And after I got involved in politics, I was elected state senator for District 36 here. And I only served one term for the simple fact that my husband, the last year, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so I felt that my job was at home then.
At 16, after you were married once, and then right after you divorced, you went into the service.
Mm-hmm. And I met my second husband, the father of my children. I was head of the admissions and dispositions for the hospital at that time, and he was a patient.
Let's go even further back. When you first enlisted, and why you enlisted
okay.
in the Air Force? Was it the Air Force at that time?
Yes, it was the Air Force. However, the flight that they put me in 1954 was, they said, now, it's WAF, and women come before the Air Force, so you must be educated as a woman. And I'm standing there, and I'm going, what in the world are they talking about? They taught us how to put on lipstick and do all of those things, and none of us had signed up to learn. We knew how to be women. We wanted to know how to shoot a gun and a lot of other things that they never would teach us.
And how old were you then?
Well, I had to be 18. And then they put me into my training. I was trained as a neuropsych technician. That's neurology and psychology. And I got my training as a medic. And when they trained us in the neuropsych, they showed us things that they did at that particular time that now would be considered, well, like the water thing that they do.
Waterboarding?
Yeah. They taught, and not only that, but we also had one that I hated. It was for if you were very depressed, I mean very depressed, they would put you in this big old bathtub. And then they put ice on you. And they put ice on you clear up to here. Your whole body was involved. And then they would put a tarp on top of that with a thing so that your head stuck out. And you would stay there until the ice melted. And after that, then, you know, you were taken back to the ward, and supposedly it helped you.
To hear this segment with Alan Steele and Emily Guerra and other segments, go to the StoryCorps page under radio at krwg.org. We'll have another portion of this interview coming up on Monday during KRWG News at 7:45. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. In focus on KRWG News this week, the continuing push to legalize recreational cannabis in the state of New Mexico. This is once again a major topic of discussion in the state's legislative session, but once again, there are major questions about whether or not there are enough votes to pass a bill. There are a number of ideas floating around in the session from both Republicans and Democrats. And we, this week, take an in-depth look at this from the first episode of the new season of the podcast Growing Forward, produced by New Mexico PBS. That station's correspondent Megan Kamrick is one of the moderators, along with Andy Lyman of New Mexico Political Report. And Lyman began the discussion with Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth by asking Wirth, what are the key requirements for a bill?
Well, one of the big issues that's kind of been really promoted by the drug policy group is the whole issue of criminal justice and impacts on various communities. And that's something that, you know, over the discussion with various sponsors that have been more focused on the business elements of it, the medical component, those kind of things, we've made it very clear that whatever bill passes is going to need to address those fundamental underlying issues. And so I'm feeling confident just based on my conversations that is being, that those elements are being incorporated. And we'll see exactly what it looks like. But I just think that, you know, for example, medical producers who have obviously had a niche and are used to things the way that they are, you know, this is a, there's a whole string of issues they're focused on. And we just want to make sure that those, the underlying justice, social justice issues don't get lost. So I think that will certainly be something that's, that needs to be in the final bill. Another piece that I think is very important is that we don't do damage or harm to the medical cannabis program. Again, it's, you know, I was in the legislature in 2007 when this passed, and our current governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, was the health secretary. And I just think that it's a program that really, you know, has been a model for how it's been rolled out, how it's worked. And we want to make sure that, you know, it stays intact and is still a functioning program. So that'll be another, a big issue. And then really the details that you get into are licenses and plant counts and obviously issues that, current providers, again, medical providers, get concerned about. And there's the big boys and the smaller groups, and those are all the things that need to get worked out. I'm hopeful, you know, one thing you hear is that this is our drop dead point, and this is where we can't go any farther. You know, again, as a lawyer who does a lot of mediation in my legal practice, you hear that a lot. And of course, that's part of negotiating. At the end of the day, though, we really need to get this done. So I'm hopeful that we can shape it and make it work.
So can I just jump in? There was a really big push last year. It did not succeed. What are you taking away from that in terms of why that didn't pass and what needs to be different this year to get a bill passed?
Yeah, Megan, it's a good question. Of course, it was a 30-day session, which is much harder to pass anything. And we ended up where we don't want to be this session. We ended up with a bill basically that was later in the session in Senate Judiciary. And instead of the work being done on the front end going into that committee, basically the bill was presented. And then, you know, the chair of Senate Judiciary, Senator Cervantes, who has concerns about legalization, basically had a bill that wasn't ready. And so I think it's a lesson for how not to do it. We need to make sure that when the legislation does get to Senate Judiciary, you know, the work has been done by the advocates, by the legislators. Another thing I'll say about the bill last year, of course, it was done by the governor's task force, and it didn't have as much legislative involvement. This year, I know the legislators have been working very hard kind of in shaping and crafting these bills. And that's the type of kind of from the ground up versus the top down approach that I think is needed for a legislation of this kind. So again, we just can't get it into a final committee in a place where it's not really ready to go.
So the other sort of thing that seems to be different this year is of course, every year that these sort of proposals come up, there's just straight out opponents that say we shouldn't do this. And of course, this year we've got this added mix of people saying we should do it, but we should do it this specific way or that specific way. We still have the opponents, I'm guessing, that are going to come out and say we shouldn't do this. What sort of measures can we take, or can the Senate or legislature as a whole take to sort of get everyone on board? Obviously, no one's going to vote for this, but is there a way to convince these opponents that this is the right thing to do?
Well, it's a good question, Andy. And again, you learn in this game that, you know, the key is getting the right number of votes to advance it to the next committee and taking it one step at a time and really kind of seeing where where the opposition is and having a constructive discussion about it. Because again, I do think that it's important to listen and there's legitimate concerns that are raised. What also has changed, I know you've reported on this, Arizona is now in this game. Obviously Colorado is well into it. And it just feels like it's there's also an economic argument that I know the governor has really pushed, which makes more sense than ever, given our need to diversify away from oil and gas. And so you've kind of got a variety of different arguments and different reasons for supporting it. And then there's obviously reasons for not supporting it. So I'm hopeful that we can listen. And you know, we've had over the last couple of years, there has also been Republican support for various proposals. And that's something I'm looking forward to as well, is to see whether or not there's a way to get to make this bipartisan. It is a bipartisan issue. It should not be partisan and lined up that way. And so, again, those are going to be important discussions to have. And I would just note finally that the new makeup of the Senate Judiciary Committee, both Senator Pirtle and Senator Moores, have been involved in discussions about how to do this, and kind of discussions we had two sessions ago about different options. And so, again, I think that it's key to have them also at the table in trying to shape this in a way that can get that kind of bipartisan support.
You're doing a great job of anticipating some of the questions. I'm sorry, Megan, did you have another question?
No, I was going to jump in. You had said you want to protect the medical cannabis program. So as we've talked about in the podcast, so people know there's really no difference between medical cannabis and recreational cannabis, but it's how it's structured and regulated. So do you have thoughts about what we need to do to ensure that we protect the medical cannabis program so patients can get the supply they need, even if we totally legalize and make it recreational?
Well, you've touched on one of the key underlying issues is supply. And again, other states that have legalized have run into huge problems with that when all of a sudden the recreational market dominates and there's not the supply of medicine in the medical program. So again, you know, as the leader, one of the challenges is, you know, when do you kind of jump into the weeds on a weeds is probably quote unquote on a bill like this. And so, again, I'm looking forward to kind of seeing the specifics of how it's done. And I've heard loud and clear, you know, from medical providers that I've met with that they want to make sure that program doesn't get rolled over by a recreational program. So in terms, Megan, of all the different things that need to be in place to prevent that type of rolling from happening, you know, I want to wait and see. I can't give you at this moment exactly what these bills look like, how we're going to do that. But I just think from an overall kind of strategy standpoint of getting something across the finish line, we can't have a bill that has the whole medical cannabis industry opposing it. That's a recipe for disaster. So it's got to be something that can work and maintain the medical program, which, again, New Mexico has been really a leader in that.
I know some of the concerns people have raised around equity, you touched on the criminal justice issues, expungement for past marijuana offenses, but there's also this idea of who gets to benefit. And in terms of, are we going to open up and have a lot of outside companies that come in and set up shop here? Will we have ways to allow local entrepreneurs to get more involved in this, but especially people from communities that have borne the brunt of this plant being criminalized? And I don't know how much we've talked about this in the podcast, like how, and Andy has talked about this in terms of the legislature, how much are we going to put in the bill in statute? How much is going to be worked out in rulemaking, and what is important to have in statute versus rulemaking?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, because you can kill a bill by getting too in depth about some specifics that do really need to be worked out in rulemaking. I will say, you know, it's important to me to protect New Mexico small businesses. And that is something that, you know, we don't want, you know, huge out-of-state company producer to come in here and basically use the economy of scale that they have to basically undercut all the New Mexico businesses that have kind of been developed around the medical program. So that's an issue, you know, we need to look at. And that's one of the challenges for sure. Because again, to the extent there's a sense and a feeling that that's the direction this would go, we're going to end up with lots of New Mexico businesses opposed to the bill. And so, you know, I think there is a fine line that gets us through the challenges and the things we have to navigate on this piece of legislation. And so really, though, it's going to take a huge effort by the sponsors to work with those that are advocating for each particular version to try and kind of to come up with something that can address, you know, these key issues and do so in a way that gets it down to the floor where I do think if it gets to the floor, it will pass.
Through all these conversations, obviously, the big issue here as we're having these conversations is that we don't actually have bills to sort of examine and break down and get analysis on. But earmarks seem to be another issue that people have sort of changed on. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on the right way, just philosophically, should we earmark tax revenue from this? Should we just put it into the general fund and figure it out later?
Yeah, it's a great question, Andy, and it is there. And you will see, and Senator Candelaria, who's one of the key sponsors of one of the Senate bills, I think sits on the Senate Finance Committee, and there really is a hesitation to earmark money instead of putting it in the general fund and then using the money out of the general fund, appropriating it for the appropriate programs. So that's a debate that needs to happen. Last year's version, there was a lot of discussion about earmarks and specific earmarks. I think it was felt were needed for certain votes to be able to get it across the line. You know, I'm feeling more confident about the vote count on the Senate floor. And so, you know, there are important pieces that I think can be addressed through some earmarks, but I'm cautious about just taking all the money and directing it in a certain direction. I do think that a balance can be found here, you know, that addresses, you know, some education issues and underlying treatment issues. I mean, these are all incredibly important things that we need to be doing. And, you know, whether it's a specific earmark that does it or an appropriation that comes out of the general fund now that we have this additional revenue, once we get this passed, I think those things need to happen. So that's not the issue. It's just the mechanical way that we do it, earmark versus into the general fund with an appropriation out.
Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth on the New Mexico PBS podcast, Growing Forward. Thanks so much for joining us for KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino, broadcasting from New Mexico State University. This is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.